I looked as he spoke, and saw black thunderclouds hovering over the earth and gathering dark as night, and a sound as of a rushing storm swept upwards from the dark spheres of hell, and like the waves of a storm, tossed ocean these dark clouds of spirits rolled up against the sea of bright spirits, sweeping them back and rolling over the earth, as though to blot out from it the light of truth, and they assailed each door of light and sought to overwhelm it. Then did this war in the spirit world become a war amongst men, nation fighting against nation for supremacy. It seemed as though in the great thirst for wealth and greed for conquest, all nations and all peoples must be engulfed, so universal was this war. And I looked to see whether none to aid, none who would come forth from the realms of light and wrest from the dark spirits their power over the earth. The seething mass of dark spirits were attacking those doors of light and striving to sweep away those poor faithful mortals who stood within them, that man might be driven back to the days of his ignorance again. Then it was that like a star in the east I saw a light, glittering and dazzling all by its brightness, and it came down and down, and grew till I saw it was a vast host of radiant angels from the heavenly spheres, and with their coming those other bright spirits whom I had seen driven back by the forces of evil gathered together again and joined those glorious warriors, and this great ocean of light, this mighty host of bright spirits swept down to earth and surrounded it with a great belt of glorious light. Everywhere I saw the rays of light, like spears, darting down and rending the dark mass in a thousand places. Like swords of fire flashed these dazzling rays and cut through the dark wall of spirits on all sides, scattering them to the four winds of heaven. Vainly did their leaders seek to gather their forces together again, vainly seek to drive them on. A stronger power was opposed to them, and they were hurled back by the brightness of these hosts of heaven till, like a dark and evil mist, they sank down, rolling back to those dark spheres from which they had come. And who are these bright angels? I asked again. These warriors who never drew back yet never slew, who held in check these mighty forces of evil, not with a sword of destruction but by the force of their mighty wills, by the eternal power of good over evil. And the answer was, they are those who are also the redeemed ones of the darkest spheres, who long, long ages ago have washed their sin, stained garments in the pools of repentance, and have, by their own labors, risen from the ashes of their dead selves to higher things, not through a belief in the sacrifice of an innocent life for their sins, but by many years of earnest labors, many acts of atonement, by sorrow and by bitter tears, by many weary hours of striving to conquer first the evil in themselves that they who have overcome may help others who sin to do so likewise. These are the angels of the heavenly spheres of earth, once men like themselves and able to sympathize with all the struggles of sinful men. A mighty host they are, ever strong to protect, powerful to save. My vision of the earth and its surroundings faded away, and in its stead I beheld one lone star shining above me with a pure silver light. And its ray fell like a thin thread of silver upon the earth and upon the spot where my beloved dwelt. A kinsman said to me, "Behold the star of her earthly destiny, how clear and pure it shines, and know, O beloved pupil, that for each soul born upon earth there shines in the spiritual heavens such a star whose path is marked out when the soul is born, a path it must follow to the end, unless by an act of suicide it sever the thread of the earthly life and by thus transgressing a law of nature plunge itself into great sorrow and suffering." Do you mean that the fate of every soul is fixed, and that we are but straws floating on a stream of our destiny? Not quite. The great events of the earth life are fixed. They will inevitably be encountered at certain periods of the earthly existence, and they are such events as those wise guardians of the angelic spheres deem to be calculated to develop and educate that soul. How these events will affect the life of each soul, whether they shall be the turning point for good or ill, for happiness or for sorrow, rests with the soul itself, and this is the prerogative of our free will, without which we would be but puppets, irresponsible for our acts and worthy of neither reward nor punishment for them. But to return to that star, note that while the mortal follows the destined path with earnest endeavor to do right in all things, while the soul is pure and the thoughts unselfish, then does that star shine out with a clear unsullied ray, and light the pathway of the soul. The light of this star comes from the soul and is the reflection of its purity. If, then, the soul ceases to be pure, if it develops its lower instead of its higher attributes, the star of that soul's destiny will grow pale and faint, the light flickering like some will, oh, there, wisp hovering over a dark morass. No longer will it shine as a clear beacon of the soul, and at last, if the soul become very evil, the light of the star will die out and expire, to shine no more upon its earthly path. It is by watching these spiritual stars and tracing the path marked out for them in the spiritual heavens, that spirit seers are able to foretell the fate of each soul, and from the light given by the star to say whether the life of the soul is good or evil. Adieu, and may the new field of your labors yield you the fairest fruits. He ceased speaking and my soul seemed to sink down and down till I reached the spirit body I had left lying on my couch, and for a brief moment as I re-entered it I lost consciousness. Then I awoke to find myself in my own room, with those beautiful white angels hovering over me, symbols, as my father had said, of eternal protection and love. End of this part of A. Farnese, amanuensis to Francesco. 144 Comte Street, Germain, forgotten immortal mystic of the mystery schools. Comte Street, Germain. Comte Street, Germain is one that has been remembered by a few, in part, because of his legendary immortality. There are those who believe that Comte Street, Germain was alive hundreds, even thousands, of years ago and remains alive together in the unique state of immortality that he has been able to attain through his mastery of the science of alchemy. We present this unique forgotten mystic because of his fascinating life, work and legend. From the Trinity Sophia. A strong wind arose and I had difficulty in keeping my lamp alight. At last I saw a white marble platform to which I mounted by 9 steps. Arrived at the last one I beheld a vast expanse of water. To my right I heard the impetuous tumbling of torrents, to my left a cold rain mixed with masses of hail fell near me. I was contemplating this majestic scene when the star which had guided me to the platform and which was slowly swinging overhead, plunged into the gulf. Believing that I was reading the commands of the Most High, I threw myself into the midst of the waves. An invisible hand seized my lamp and placed it on the crown of my head. I breasted the foamy wave and struggled to reach the side opposite the one which I had left. At last I saw on the horizon a feeble gleam and hastened forward. Perspiration streamed down my face and I exhausted myself in vain efforts. The shore which I could scarcely discern seemed to recede to the degree one advanced. My strength was ebbing. I feared not to die, but to die without illumination. I lost courage, and lifting to the vault my tear, streaming eyes I cried out, Judica judicium mam et redeem me, propter eloquium tuam vivificam me. Judge thou my judgment and redeem me. By thy eloquence make me live. I could hardly move my tired limbs and was sinking more and more when near me I saw a boat. A richly dressed man guided it. I noticed that the prow was turned toward the shore which I had left. He drew near. A golden crown shone on his forehead. Vade me come, said he, mecum principium in terris, instruam te in vihac quae gradueris. Come with me, the foremost in the world, I will show thee the way thou must follow. I instantly answered him, Bonum est prayer in domino quam consider in principibus. It is better to trust in the Lord than to sit among the mighty, whereupon the boat sank and the monarch with it. Fresh energy seemed to course through my veins and I gained the goal of my efforts. I found myself on a shore covered with green sand. A silver wall was before me inlaid with 2 panels of red marble. Approaching I noticed on one of them sacred script, the other being engraved with a line of Greek letters. Between the 2 plates was an iron circle. 2 lions, one red and the other black, rested on clouds and appeared to guard a golden crown above them. Also near the circle were to be seen a bow and 2 arrows. I read several characters written on the flanks of one of the lions. I had barely observed these different emblems when they vanished together with the wall which contained them. The Most Holy Trina Sophia of the Comte Street Germain, Phoenix Press, Los Angeles, California. Like many mystics before and after him, He was taken into the hellish realms and then into the heavenlies. One very interesting aspect of his writings, however, includes actual depictions of inscriptions in unknown languages on various altars that he sees in his mystical visions. Hellish journey below the earth. When I awoke, I was lying on a luxurious cushion. The air I breathed was saturated with the fragrance of flowers. A blue robe spangled with golden stars had replaced my linen garment. A yellow altar stood opposite me, from which a pure flame ascended, having no other substance for its alimentation than the altar itself. Letters in black were engraved at the base of the altar. A lighted torch stood beside it, shining like the sun. Hovering above it was a bird with black feet, silvery body, a red head, black wings and a golden neck. It was in constant motion without, however, using its wings. It could only fly when in the midst of the flames. In its beak was a green branch. Its name is the name of the altar is altar, bird and torch are the symbol of all things. Nothing can be done without them. They themselves are all that is good and great. The name of the torch is four inscriptions surrounded these different emblems. From the most holy Trina Sophia of the Comte de Street Germain, introductions by Mandy P. Hall, Phoenix Press, Los Angeles. I turned aside and noticed an immense palace, the base of which rested on clouds. Its mass was composed of marble and its form was triangular. Four tiers of columns were raised one above the other. A golden ball topped the edifice. The first tier of columns was white, the second black, the third green and the last one a brilliant red. I intended, after having admired this work of immortal artists, to return to the place of the altar, the bird and the torch. I desired to study them further. They had disappeared and with my eyes I was searching for them when the doors of the palace opened. A venerable old man came forth clad in a robe like mine, except that a golden sun shone on his breast. His right hand held a green branch, the other upheld a censer. A wooden chain was about his neck and a pointed tiara like that of Zoroaster covered his white head. He came toward me, a benevolent smile on his lips. "Adore God," said he to me in Persian. "It is He who sustained thee in thy trials, His spirit was with thee. My son, thou hast let slip by the opportunity. Thou couldst have seized instantly the bird, the torch and the altar. Thou wouldst have become altar, bird and torch at one and the same time. Now, in order to arrive at the most secret place of the Palace of Sublime Sciences, it will be necessary for thee to pass through all by ways. Come. I must first of all present thee to my brothers." He took me by the hand and led me into a vast hall. The eyes of the vulgar cannot conceive the form and richness of the ornaments which embellished it. 360 columns enclosed it on all sides. Suspended from a golden ring in the ceiling was a cross of red, white, blue and black. In the center of the hall was a triangular altar composed of the four elements. On its three points were placed the bird, the altar and the torch. "Their names are now changed," said my guide. "Here the bird is called at some distance from the shore a sumptuous palace raised aloft its alabaster columns. Its different parts were joined by porticos of flame color. The entire edifice was of light and airy architecture. As I approached the portals, I saw that the front was decorated with the figure of a butterfly. The doors stood open. I entered. The entire palace consisted of a single hall, surrounded by a triple colonnade, each rank composed of 27 alabaster columns. In the middle of the building stood the figure of a man issuing from a tomb. His hand, holding up a lance, struck the stone which previously confined him. His loins were girt about with a green garment, gold gleamed from its hem. On his breast was a square tablet bearing several letters. Above this figure hung a golden crown, and the figure seemed to lift itself into the air in order to seize the crown. Above it was a yellow stone tablet bearing several emblems, which I explained by means of the inscription I saw on the tomb and by the one I had seen on the breast of the man. I stayed in that hall which is called the Time Needful for contemplating all its aisles, and soon I left it with the intention of crossing a vast plain in order to reach a tower that I had perceived at quite some distance. And also like many mystics before and after him, he was eventually led through the doors of immortality after discarding the earthly garment through purification and many rites of passage. After that time I left it in order to enter a large place surrounded by colonnades and gilded porticos. In the center of the place stood a bronze pedestal supporting a group representing a large strong man whose majestic head was covered with a crowned helmet. A blue garment protruded through the meshes of his golden armor. In one hand he held a white staff bearing certain characters, the other hand he extended toward a beautiful woman. His companion wore no garment, but a sun radiated from her breast. Her right hand held three globes joined by golden rings, a coronet of red flowers confined her beautiful hair. She sprang into the air and seemed to lift with her the warrior who accompanied her. Both were borne up by the clouds about the group. On the capitals of four white marble columns were set four bronze statues, they had wings and appeared to sound trumpets. I crossed the place, and mounting on a marble platform which was before me, I noticed with astonishment that I had re-entered the Hall of Thrones, the first in which I had found myself when entering the Palace of Wisdom. The triangular altar was still in the center of this hall, but the bird, the altar and the torch were joined and formed a single body. Near them was a golden sun. The sword which I had brought from the Hall of Fire lay a few paces distant on the cushion of one of the thrones. I took up the sword and struck the sun, reducing it to dust. I then touched it and each molecule became a golden sun like the one I had broken. At that instant a loud and melodious voice exclaimed, "The work is perfect." Hearing this, the children of light hastened to join me, the doors of immortality were opened to me, and the cloud which covers the eyes of mortals, was dissipated. I saw and the spirits which preside over the elements knew me for their master. The Comte de Street Germain. By Isabel Cooper, Oakley, mystic and philosopher. He was, perhaps, one of the greatest philosophers who ever lived. The friend of humanity, wishing for money only that he might give to the poor. A friend to animals, his heart was concerned only with the happiness of others. During the last quarter of every 100 years an attempt is made by those masters, of whom I have spoken, to help on the spiritual progress of humanity. Towards the close of each century you will invariably find that an outpouring or upheaval of spirituality, or call it mysticism if you prefer, has taken place. Some one or more persons have appeared in the world as their agents, and a greater or less amount of occult knowledge or teaching has been given out. The Key to Theosophy, p. 194. Blavatsky. The Comte de Street Germain was certainly the greatest Oriental adept Europe has seen during the last centuries. Among the strange mysterious beings, with which the 18th century was so richly dowered, no one has commanded more universal comment and attention than the mystic who was known by the name of the Comte de Street Germain. A hero of romance, a charlatan, a swindler and an adventurer, rich and varied were the names that showered freely upon him. Hated by the many, loved and reverenced by the few, time has not yet lifted the veil which screened his true mission from the vulgar speculators of the period. Then, as now, the occultist was dubbed charlatan by the ignorant. Only some men and women here and there realized the power of which he stood possessed. The friend and counselor of kings and princes, an enemy to ministers who were skilled in deception, he brought his great knowledge to help the West, to stave off in some small measure the storm clouds that were gathering so thickly around some nations. Alas! His words of warning fell on deafened ears, and his advice went all unheeded. Looking back from this distance of time, it will be of interest to many students of mysticism to trace the life, so far as it may yet be told, of this great occultist. Sketches are to be found here and there from various writers, mostly antagonistic, but no coherent detailed account of his life has yet appeared. This is very largely owing to the fact that the most interesting and important work, done by M. de Street Germain, lies buried in the secret archives of many princely and noble families. With this fact we have become acquainted during the careful investigations which we have been making on the subject. Where the archives are situated we have also learned, but we have not yet in all cases received permission to make the necessary researches. It must be borne in mind that the Comte de Saint-Germain, alchemist and mystic, does not belong to the French family of Saint-Germain, from which descended Count Robert de Saint-Germain. The latter was born in the year 1708, at Lons, Le, Saulnier, was first a Jesuit, and entered later in turn the French, Palatine, and Russian military services. He became Danish Minister of War under Count Struensee, then re-entered the French service, and at the beginning of the reign of Louis XVI. He tried, as Minister of War, to introduce various changes into the French army. These raised a violent storm of indignation. He was disgraced by the king and finally died in 1778. He is so often confounded with his mystic and philosophic namesake, that for the sake of clearing up the ignorance that prevails on the matter, it is well to give these brief details, showing the difference between the two men. Unfortunately, the disgrace into which the soldier fell is but too often attributed to the mystic, to whom we will now turn our entire attention. That M. de Saint-Germain had intimate relations with many high persons in various countries is quite undeniable, the testimony on this point being overwhelming. That such relations should cause jealousy and unkindly speculation is unfortunately not rare in any century. Let us, however, see what some of these princely friends say. When questioned by the Herzog Karl August as to the supernatural age of this mystic, the Landgraf von Hessen-Philipps, Barkfeld replied, "We cannot speak with certainty on that point. The fact is the Count is acquainted with details about which only contemporaries of that period could give us information. It is now the fashion in Kassel to listen respectfully to his statements and not to be astonished at anything. The Count is known not to be an importunate sycophant. He is a man of good society to whom all are pleased to attach themselves. He at all events stands in close relation with many men of considerable importance, and exercises an incomprehensible influence on others. My cousin the Landgraf Karl von Hessen is much attached to him. They are eager Freemasons, and work together at all sorts of hidden arts. He is supposed to have intercourse with ghosts and supernatural beings, who appear at his call. Herr Morvillen, in spite of his personal prejudice against M. de Saint-Germain, is obliged to acknowledge the feeling of the Duke towards the great alchemist. For on his supposed death being mentioned in the Brunswick newspaper of the period, wherein M. de Saint-Germain was spoken of as a man of learning, a lover of truth, devoted to the good and a hater of baseness and deception, the Duke himself wrote to the editor, expressing his approbation of the announcement. In France M. de Saint-Germain appears to have been under the personal care, and enjoying the affection of Louis XV. Who repeatedly declared that he would not tolerate any mockery of the Count, who was of high birth. It was this affection and protection that caused the Prime Minister, the Duke de Choiseul, to become a bitter enemy of the mystic, although he was at one time friendly to him, since the Baron de Glitchen in his memoirs says, M. de Saint-Germain frequented the house of M. de Choiseul, and was well received there. The same writer, who later became one of his devoted students, testifies to the fact that M. de Saint-Germain ate no meat, drank no wine, and lived according to a strict regime. Louis XV gave him a suite of rooms in the royal Château de Chambord, and he constantly spent whole evenings at Versailles with the king and the royal family. One of the chief difficulties we find in tracing his history consists in the constant changes of name and title, a proceeding which seems to have aroused much antagonism and no little doubt. This fact should not, however, have made the public of the period dislike him, for it appears to have been the practice of persons of position, who did not wish to attract vulgar curiosity. Thus, for instance, we have the Duke de Medici travelling in the years 1698 and 1700 under the name of the Conte di Siena. The Graf Marcolini, when he went from Dresden to Leipzig to meet M. de Saint-Germain, adopted another name. The Cur, Prince Friedrich, Christian von Saxon travelled in Italy from 1738 to 1740, under the name Count Lausitz. Nearly all the members of the royal families in every country, during the last century, and even in this, adopted the same practice, but when M. de Saint-Germain did so, We have all the small writers of that period and later calling him an adventurer and a charlatan for what appears to have been, practically, a custom of the time. Let us now make a list of these names and titles, bearing in mind that they cover a period of time dating from 1710 to 1822. The first date is mentioned by Baron de Glitchin, who says, "I have heard Raymond, an old relative of a French ambassador at Venice, testify to having known M. de St. Germain in 1710, when he had the appearance of a man of 50 years of age." The second date is mentioned by M. de Hemer in her most interesting souvenirs, Z. Marie Antoinette. During this time we have M. de St. Germain as the Marquis de Montferrat, Comte Bellamarore Aimerat Venice, Chevalier Sir-Enning at Pisa, Chevalier Weldon at Milan and Leipzig, Comte Soltikoff at Genoa and Leghorn, Graf Serigy at Schwalbach and Triesdorf, Prince Rigozzi at Dresden, and Comte de St. Germain at Paris, The Hague, London, and St. Petersburg. No doubt all these varied changes gave ample scope and much material for curious speculations. A few words may fitly here be said about his personal appearance and education. From one contemporary writer we get the following sketch: "He looked about 50, is neither stout nor thin, has a fine intellectual countenance, dresses very simply, but with taste. He wears the finest diamonds on snuff, box, watch and buckles. Much of the mystery with which he is surrounded is owing to his princely liberality." Another writer, who knew him when at Anspach, says, "He always dined alone and very simply, his wants were extremely few, it was impossible while at Anspach to persuade him to dine at the prince's table." M. de St. Germain appears to have been very highly educated. According to Carl von Weber, he spoke German, English, Italian, Portuguese and Spanish very well, and French with a Piedmontese accent. It was almost universally accorded that he had a charming grace and courtliness of manner. He displayed, moreover, in society, a great variety of gifts, played several musical instruments excellently, and sometimes showed facilities and powers which bordered on the mysterious and incomprehensible. For example, one day he had dictated to him the first 20 verses of a poem, and wrote them simultaneously with both hands on two separate sheets of paper. No one present could distinguish one sheet from the other. In order to arrive at some orderly sequence, it will be well to divide our material into three parts. Footnotes to this last pages. 1. Theories about his birth and character, with personal details, some of which we have briefly noticed. 2. His travels and knowledge. 3. His political and mystical work. Beginning, then, with our first division, the theories about his birth and nationality are many and various, and different authors, according to their prejudices, trace his descent from prince or tax gatherer, apparently as fancy dictates. Thus, among other parentages, we find him supposed to be descended from 1. The widow of Charles II, King of Spain, the father a Madrid banker. 2. A Portuguese Jew. 3. An Alsatian Jew. 4.